This is the Daily Radio Ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the Gospel of Matthew. Now, here's Pastor Sandy. Please open your Bibles and let's join Pastor Sandy in the Gospel of Matthew, chapters 8 and 9.
Since its release in 1994, the animated motion picture, The Lion King, has grossed over $768 million. It ranks in the top 25 of all-time blockbusters. If you have kids younger than 20 years old, you've probably seen The Lion King. The story's about a young lion cub named Simba and his struggle to regain the kingdom that has been stolen from his father, Mufasa, the former Lion King. The evil villain Scar has taken control of the jungle and he's ruined life for all of the animals. One night, while gazing into a starry sky, Simba hears the voice of his father say to him, "You are my son and the one true king." His father's affirmation is what motivates Simba to embark on his mission. He returns to overthrow Scar and his vicious hyenas. Simba liberates the animals and proves that he is the true Lion King. Though not a perfect analogy by any stretch, the fairy tale does, though, have some striking similarities to the book of Matthew. In chapter 1, we have the genealogy of Jesus. It proves that Jesus is the Lion King. It records his messianic pedigree. It proves that Jesus is the Lion of the tribe of Judah. Chapter 2 tells of his birth and his enemy's attempt to kill him. In chapter 3, his father speaks from heaven and reaffirms his identity. In chapter 4, Jesus takes on Scar, the devil, in a wilderness showdown. Chapters 5 through 7 are Jesus' explanation of what life is like in his kingdom. But now in chapter 8, the Lion King roars. Jesus begins to strip Scar and his hyenas of their strongholds. He liberates the animals of the jungle from disease and demons. Jesus shows his power even over nature. Jesus begins to prove to the people of the Galilee that he alone is the Lion King. Chapter 8 begins, "When he had come down from the mountain, great multitudes followed him, and behold, a leper." Leprosy was the AIDS of the ancient world. It was an incurable disease that started out as a white patch on the skin. That white patch became an ulcerated sore. Eventually, leprosy ate away the flesh and caused all manner of physical deformities. Lepers lost ears and noses, fingers and toeses. Leprosy turned feet into nubs. Research has revealed that leprosy numbs the nerves and it causes the inability to feel pain. A leper can burn a hand or even wash his face in scalding water and be oblivious to the damage that it does. Leprosy has been called the painless hell. In third world countries, rats will nibble at a leper's feet while he sleeps because he can't feel the pain. It all happens to him undetected. Medical missionary Paul Brand used to do plastic surgery among lepers in India. As a post-op procedure, he would send the patient home with a cat to chase away the rats. Perhaps the worst effect of leprosy was the emotional pain that was involved. You see, lepers were quarantined from other people. If a healthy person came near, it was the leper's duty to shout, "Unclean, unclean," and drive the person away. According to the rabbis, a leper had to stay 6 feet from other people at all times. If the wind was blowing, the separation grew to over 100 feet. Some rabbis threw stones at lepers to drive them away. One rabbi wrote, "I would not buy an egg from a market that was on a street that a leper had walked down." You see, the word leprosy means smitten. And the leper was indeed considered smitten by God. A leper was not allowed in the temple. Technically, he couldn't pray or even offer a sacrifice. He was not only cut off from his friends and family, but the leper was cut off from God. And yet here is a bold man. Here is a leopard of a leper. In his desperation, he violates all boundaries and decorum. He pushes through the crowd and he approaches Jesus. And behold, a leper came and worshiped him, saying, "Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean." Now, this man had faith. He knew that Jesus was able, but he wasn't sure that Jesus was willing. This is our problem sometimes. You see, in addition to his leprosy, this leper also suffered from a faulty view of God. He was worried that because of his miserable condition, God wouldn't help him. Many people today suffer from that same concept. People think that they have to clean up before they can receive God's help. That God doesn't help sinners until sinners help themselves. Guys, this couldn't be more false. Notice what Jesus does. Then he put out his hand and he touched him. In the original language, it's stronger. He gripped him, saying, "I am willing, be cleansed." And immediately, his leprosy was cleansed. Jesus deliberately embraced the outcast. The word might even imply a hug. Jesus didn't just speak the word. He hugged the leper into healing. It had been a long time since a healthy hand or a healthy arm had touched the skin of this unloved leper. And Jesus didn't have to touch him to heal him. So often Jesus would just speak the word and a healing would occur. But the love of Jesus touched this man and healed him emotionally even before he was healed physically. These verses prove to you and me that Jesus' holiness doesn't keep him from touching the unclean and the outcast. I don't know about you, but I'm thankful. Jesus said to him, "See that you tell no one, but go your way, show yourself to the priest, and offer the gift that Moses commanded as a testimony to them." Jesus tells him that he needs to obey the law, Leviticus 14. He needs to go and show himself to the priest. But here's the amazing command, "And see that you tell no one." Oh my. Think about it. This man had spent years alienated from family and from society. Now his forced exile is over. How are you going to keep this guy from shouting his praise and thanks from the rooftops? And yet Jesus tells him, "See that you tell no one." Jesus' motivation for this strange command is actually twofold. First, Jesus knows man's lust for the miraculous. Think about it. People tend to follow a miracle without ever considering where it might lead. Jesus was afraid that his miracles would create a mob that would certainly want his miracles, but would stop short of sharing his intentions and his ultimate objectives. This is why he tried to downplay any publicity in the wake of his miracles. And the second reason he said, "Tell no one," throughout his ministry, you're going to find that Jesus never sought his own glory. Jesus' miracles were designed to alleviate suffering, to stimulate faith, to illustrate truth, but they were never done to manipulate people or to elevate his own status. Jesus is the ultimate example for you and me. Jesus came to give God glory, and that should be our intention. Notice verse 5. "Now when Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him, pleading with him, saying, 'Lord, my servant is lying at home paralyzed, dreadfully tormented.'" Now a centurion was a battle-scarred sergeant in the Roman army. He commanded a century, which was 100 men. He fought with these men in the trenches. And often a centurion would grow fond of his men, his soldiers. For this particular sarge, a servant had won his respect and gained his trust. And when this servant became sick, the soldier went to Jesus for help. And Jesus said to him, "I will come and heal him." Now, you got to understand, next to lepers, Roman centurions were the most hated men in Israel. The Jews despised the Roman occupation of their land, and these centurions were Rome's enforcers. Most Jews would have no time for sergeants. Not Jesus. The centurion answered and said, "Lord, I am not worthy that you should come under my roof, but only speak a word and my servant will be healed. This servant was a wise man. He realized that he had never lived by the law. In fact, until his servant got sick, he hadn't even believed in God, rarely even thought of God. This pagan Roman knew that he was unworthy of God's attention, let alone a miracle. But this man had faith in Jesus. He says, "For I also am a man under authority, having soldiers under me. And I say to this one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and then he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it." You see, a servant was sort of a mid-level manager in the Roman military. And he knew the chain of command. He knew how to give orders, and he knew how to take orders. And this centurion knew Jesus' place in the hierarchy. He knew that Jesus was God. No one could do these miracles except he were from God. Jesus had the authority to command even disease to flee. This centurion knew that if the Lion King just spoke a word, his sick servant would be made completely whole. When Jesus heard the man, he marveled. Jesus is about to speak a word of healing, but before he does, he speaks a word about the faith of this Roman. And he said to those who followed, "Assuredly I say to you, I have not found such great faith, not even in Israel." In the minds of most Jews, no one would have been further from God's kingdom than a Roman centurion. And yet this man is commended by Jesus for his great faith. Apparently a Gentile had more faith than the outwardly righteous Jews. Notice verse 11. "And I say to you that many will come from east and west and sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the sons of the kingdom will be cast out into outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." Remember, the Jews were blood relatives of Abraham. They were still heirs of God's kingdom and God's promises. They were the sons of the kingdom. But what happened to the centurion was a preview of what is to come. The Jews in general will be left out of God's kingdom, while many Gentiles will enter in. Salvation is about to be offered to people who have faith, not family connections. Then Jesus said to the centurion, "Go your way, and as you have believed, so let it be done for you." And his servant was healed that same hour. Notice Jesus never even made it to the house. As soon as he gave the order, the disease fled and the servant was healed. The story shows that through grace, Jesus reaches out not only to lepers but to legionnaires, to outcast Jews and to unworthy Gentiles. Guys, God not only can, but God will if you believe. Verse 14. "Now when Jesus had come into Peter's house, he saw his wife's mother lying sick with a fever." Literally, the original language reads, "She was on fire." This was a high fever. This was a serious illness. "So Jesus touched her hand, and the fever left her. And she arose and served them." Now here's a miracle. Not just that the high fever vanished, but that a mother-in-law would then become grateful and serve her son-in-law. For that matter, the whole family. Notice, after she's healed, she serves. And this is always the pattern. Don't ever forget it. If you've been healed, or if you've been touched by Jesus, if he's removed from you a high fever, then the best way for you to say thanks is to rise up in the wake of that miracle and begin to serve. Remember, Peter is about to leave all and follow Jesus. Perhaps the healing of his mother-in-law was Jesus' way of reassuring Peter that he would take care of his family. You know, whenever we leave our family, and sometimes it happens where we have to leave our family behind in order to go and serve the Lord, to do this or to do that, we can always trust Jesus to take care of our family in our absence. I think this was what Jesus was saying to Peter. Here's one more point. Notice, Peter had a mother-in-law. That means he had a wife. Because no man in his right mind would get a mother-in-law without having a wife. I mean, that's the only reason you get a mother-in-law, because you love the wife. But Peter had a wife. Next time you talk to a Roman Catholic friend, ask them if they knew that the first pope had a wife. That'll stir up some conversation. You know, the Roman Catholics claim that Peter was the first pope. But if Peter was the pope, what's he doing with a wife? And if he's not the pope, to whom does any pope trace his authority? Interesting conversation with your Catholic friends. Verse 16. When evening had come, they brought to Jesus many who were demon-possessed, and he cast out the spirits with a word and healed all who were sick. What an evening. I mean, this is evening time. Jesus is off the clock, you might say. This is not work hours. This is in the evening time. When evening had come. It's after a long day. Jesus is tired. Jesus is exhausted. The people now are interrupting his dinner. And yet you don't hear Jesus complain, do you? He puts his dinner in the microwave and he works some overtime. You know, you can't follow Jesus if you're worried about working late hours and missing a few meals. It'll never happen. Jesus healed all who were sick that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet. And here he quotes Isaiah 53 verse 4 saying, "He himself took our infirmities and bore our sicknesses." In other words, his healing ministry was a fulfillment of prophecy. Verse 18, "And when Jesus saw great multitudes about him, he gave a command to depart to the other side." Now, Jesus didn't mind working overtime, did he? I mean, he worked after hours in the evening, healing the sick and casting out demons. But Jesus also knew when it was time to withdraw and when it was time to rest. I mean, Jesus also didn't mind letting the voicemail take a call from time to time. Ministry, you see, can monopolize your time. And if you lack boundaries, if you lack order and organization in your life, you can get in real trouble. Jesus was clear. He was faithful to withdraw and to spend time with his Father. He knew that he wouldn't be much good if he lost communication with headquarters, and neither will you. In the next four verses, Jesus challenges two would-be followers. He says, "Then a certain scribe came and said to him, 'Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go.' And Jesus said to him, 'Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head.'" Understand, this world is all about arrival. It's all about getting ahead and then showing off what you've achieved. Hoping at some point, some way, someday, people will point to you and say, "He or she has arrived. They've made it to the top." But Jesus was not about getting ahead. Jesus was about passing through. Making it to the top in this life was not Jesus' goal. Notice what he says, "The Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." That's not exactly arriving, is it? Jesus' hope, Jesus' home was heaven. And if we follow him, our goal will be heaven too. Jesus was not about getting ahead. Jesus was about passing through. And Jesus was not about holding on. Jesus was about moving on. Look what he says to the next would-be disciple. "Then another of his disciples said to him, 'Lord, let me first go and bury my father.' But Jesus said to him, 'Follow me and let the dead bury their own dead.'" In other words, you can't be a follower of Jesus and be a clinger. Jesus tells this would-be follower, this wannabe, you might say, that he's got to be willing to turn loose when it's time. Are you willing to turn loose when it's time? When Jesus says move, are you ready to up anchor and set sail? Notice this with these two men. Following Jesus is not about getting ahead. It's about passing through. Following Jesus is not about holding on. It's about moving on. Are you willing to set sail when it's time? And speaking of setting sail, now when he got into a boat, his disciples followed him. And suddenly a great tempest arose on the sea so that the boat was covered with the waves. As we said this morning, the Sea of Galilee sits 685 feet below sea level. It's surrounded by mountains that funnel cold north air south. And when the cold air hits the tropical warm air on top of the lake, it causes these violent, sudden storms. In January of 1986, two Jewish fishermen found what turned out to be one of the most amazing archaeological discoveries in the last 100 years. They found a boat that was dated back to the first century AD. It was in the mud right there off the shore of the Sea of Galilee. Today, it's become a tourist attraction. They call it the Jesus boat. And it was a boat typical of the time of Jesus. It measures 26.5 feet long by 7.5 feet wide. Now imagine 10-foot seas in this tiny boat. Matthew says, a great tempest arose on the sea. The Greek word translated tempest is seismos. This was a seismic storm. This was an underwater earthquake. And when they went to find Jesus, Matthew tells us he was asleep. He may have been exhausted from ministry. He had a busy couple of days prior. And he may have just laid down in the back of the boat and fallen asleep. But then his disciples came to him and awoke him, saying, Lord, save us! We're perishing! It's interesting, when Mark writes his gospel, he gives us a detail that Matthew leaves out. Mark tells us that before boarding the boat, Jesus said this to his disciples, let us cross over to the other side. Notice that. Jesus had promised that they would cross over, not go under. But in the heat of the moment, they began to doubt. They started to panic. Guys, Jesus doesn't promise us shelter from the storms of life. Storms are part of the waters we all navigate. No one can escape them. Like the storms on the lake, storms in life arise suddenly, instantaneously, violently, when you least expect them. But Jesus promises to be in our boat, and He promises to help us cross over, not go under. Jesus eventually calms the storm, but you see, faith is learned on the water. The disciples learned to follow Jesus not just to the storm, but through the storm. There are a lot of people that follow Him to the storm. But do you have faith enough to follow Him through the storm? After the disciples woke Jesus from His nap, He tries to awaken them from their spiritual slumber. He said to them, why are you fearful, O you of little faith? Understand, following Jesus isn't just boarding the boat or in essence becoming a Christian. Faith grows courage. Faith continues to follow Jesus, even in the teeth of a storm. Well, then He arose and He rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. Notice Jesus transformed a great tempest into a great calm. He has that power. You know, it intrigues me that Jesus didn't just speak to the sea. Rather, He rebuked it. Rebuke is how you drive away a demon. I believe this storm was not just a collision of cold and warm air. It wasn't just meteorological, it was theological. The evil Scar was trying to drown the Lion King, but the lion prevailed. And so the men marveled, saying, who can this be that even the winds and the sea obey Him? I'm impressed when a guy says something and his kids obey. Who can this be that even his toddler obeys Him? I'm impressed. But how much more impressed are you when a guy says to the wind and the waves, be still, and they obey Him? This is somebody special. In fact, as the disciples concluded, this must be God. Only God has power over nature. This man must be God.
Parenting in this world can be difficult. Thankfully, God has given us His Word as the foundation for parenting and everything else in this life. Pastor Sandy has authored a short book entitled Kid Gloves, Biblical Guidelines for Handling Your Kids, that further expands on the topic of biblical parenting. We would love to get this helpful resource in your hands. Throughout this month, we're offering this book to anyone who supports Sandy Adams Radio with a gift of $10 or more. Remember, these helpful resources have a twofold purpose. First and foremost, these resources will continue to encourage you in specific areas in your discipleship. Second, they can further the reach of Sandy Adams Radio. Would you prayerfully consider supporting Sandy Adams Radio? We'd love to send you the book, Kid Gloves, Biblical Guidelines for Handling Your Kids, when you send a gift of $10 or more as a thank you. To receive your copy, visit sandyadams.org and simply click on Kid Gloves, Biblical Guidelines for Handling Your Kids. Again, that's sandyadams.org. Well, that's all the time we have for today. On behalf of Pastor Sandy and the entire production team, thank you for joining us today. And please join us again for the next edition of Sandy Adams Radio.